Thank you, Shelley. My name is Tracy Arnowski. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Truly, by the grace of God, I am a member of the Almond Family Groups, and I'm delighted to be with you all tonight. Before I get started, I want to thank you for letting me be a part of anything that's Alcoholics Anonymous, because it is truly a privilege when Al-Anon is asked to share with a bunch of drunks. And I really mean that. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love everything about it. I always say thank you to AA for everything they have given us, because we recover through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not my first time in Paris. I'm delighted to be back, and I know some of you were here when I've been here before. Nick told me it's my third time, and I'm glad he remembered, because I don't. I know it was back in the late 70s and the 80s. And so for you who have heard me before, nothing much has changed. I'm still living with the same drunk. And so I hope that maybe I'm a little bit wiser. And that's all I can say. Just because I've been here 29 years doesn't make me any brighter or any more of an authority or anything else. I'm just another Al-Anon. And it's grand to be here. Happy anniversary. And it's a lot bigger now than it was when I was here before. And it's grand to see everybody here tonight. And the food was wonderful. Thank you all, including the briskets. They just didn't eat enough, I guess. We heard a great talk this afternoon, and I know you're in for a treat after I get through. And I'll try to do it so we can get tagged on time. And our stories of food, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And I grew up in Denver, and I grew up in a non-alcoholic home. There was no drinking in our home. Dad kept a bottle for friends who had a social drink. And I didn't know what drunk was. I had no idea. I know that as a child, going to mountains where we had a cottage, we would go down Skid Row to get to the mountain road. And the winos would be asleep in the doorways on Larimer Street. And I didn't know what they were, and I used to ask Dad about them, and he'd say, "Honey, they're sick." And little did I realize that many years later, that was the same thing that I was going to say to our sons about their father, because that was all I knew. And I had fun growing up. I had a grand time. There were no problems in our home. I have an older brother and a younger brother, and we did things as a family. And everything was good. And when I got to you and built an inventory and took a fifth step, they told me to go back as far as I could remember, and I did. And everything was good until I ran headlong into a drunk. And even then, it was darn good for a lot of years. And so I love recalling the happy times. And I don't want to ever forget the happy times. Because I believe that if we do stop and think, that we have a lot more good times than we do bad, or we wouldn't hang in there. We wouldn't hang in there. I want to personally welcome the new people that are here tonight, AA and Al-Anon. And I told the little gal in the restroom before, don't keep coming back. Just stay here. And then you don't have to keep coming back. That's so important. It is for me. It is for me. I graduated high school at age 16, and I went on to the University of Colorado. I went to have a good time. I wouldn't have been interested in education. It didn't mean a darn thing to me. All I wanted to do was have fun. And all I wanted to do was get married, because, you see, back in junior high school, I discovered boys. And I discovered I liked them a whole lot better than I did girls. Haven't changed my mind a whole lot about that. And I started fantasizing about what he was going to be like when I grew up. And he was going to be 6'4", and he was going to be an All-American football player. Fantasies don't always become reality, let me tell you. Most of you in here know this. I was in university and I was having a good time in December of 41, and many of you are too young to remember that, but you read about it in your history books. And we were in World War II. And campus became hysterical, really, but we gals did particularly, because we were terrified and we didn't know what was going to happen. And the boys were all going to go into the service, and campus would become all girl. And it was just a very frightening time. And my biggest concern was that all the fellas were going to be gone, and I'd probably end up an old maid, and I was now 17. And one of my classmates was from Dallas and invited me to spend the holidays with her family. And on the train going down, she told me I would be going out with her brother's best friend. Go out with him, have a good time. Just don't believe anything he says. And you know where that went. It went right in here and right out there. Because I could be anything you wanted me to be. I didn't know that's the role I was playing. I was a great pretender. And maybe some of you can identify with that. I'm going to just do this because I keep losing my voice. I could pretend to be anything you wanted me to be. And I didn't understand that. And I didn't understand people pleasing till I got to you people. I didn't know that's what I was doing. I didn't know that I was acting. And I have come to believe that we in this program, AA or Al-Anon, could win an Oscar given the opportunity. We'll become the greatest actors in the world. Because, you know, we don't want anybody to know what's going on inside of us. We don't want anyone to know what's going on behind the walls in which we live. So what do? People ask us how we are. We're just fine, thank you. We don't think anyone knows, do we? Till we get here and then we find out there isn't anybody who doesn't know. Can't hide a drunk, can you? I tried. You can tell by the smell if you can't tell any other way. But I tried all those things. We arrived in Dallas, and there was a little guy standing there, 5'6". He took us to my friend's home, and we went out that evening. We went out every night for the next 2 weeks. After coming to you, we talked about those dating days. We didn't go anywhere. We went to a drive-in a few blocks away from my friend's home. They served beer and ale in the car. He introduced me to ale. I sat there and pretended to like that rotten stuff. God, it was awful. Whenever I think about it, I just get the willies. But I thought it was just wonderful according to what I told him. And we lied to each other. That's what we did for 2 weeks. I went back to school, wrote him a letter, and didn't hear from him. I wrote him again and didn't hear from him. I wrote him a certain time and no response. And I didn't need to hear, because campus had become military. Denver was military. We were surrounded by Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. I will never know what the Navy was doing in Colorado, but they were there. And there were at least 10 fellows to every gal. And if you think I didn't have fun, I had a ball. I fell in love with uniforms. We had sometimes as many as 2 or 3 dates a night. Had to keep the military happy. Couldn't let them get lonely. And I was falling in and out of love every time he turned around. I had no idea what love was. He'd get shipped out and another one to take his place. He'd ship out and another one would take his place. And then an invitation arrived to go to Dallas to be in a wedding. Couldn't wait to get there. He met the train. We went through the wedding parties and all of the things that go with it. And went right back to that drive-in and drank that rotten ale and lied to each other. In 2 weeks I went back to school. Wrote to him and didn't hear from him. And I went on with the military. And then another invitation to go back to Dallas to be in another wedding. Rode the same train and worried about, golly, am I ever going to find my own man? Am I always going to be a bridesmaid and never a bride? He met the train. In the same wedding, went through all of that stuff, and then went right back to the drive-in and drank that rotten ale. And this time, I went back to school with a fraternity again. And we were going to be married some 2.5 years away when he finished his education. That was in January. In April, the ring arrived in the mail, and June 10th at 8 o'clock p.m., 1943, a formal wedding, surrounded by family and friends, and the realization I know of what our families planned for us. And everything was going to be beautiful, and everything was going to be wonderful. And we left the wedding reception in Dad's car. We only had 3 days for a honeymoon, so he had me back in school, and we drove approximately 3 blocks away to the first liquor store that we could get to. And this little guy and this gal standing here were absolutely terrified. And there was no way that marriage could be consummated without help. And I crawled in that bottle with that man that night, and I stayed with him for the next 24 years. I drank with him, I drank without him, I drank alone, and I drank with other people. And I know standing here right this instant, it is only by the grace of God that I'm not an alcoholic. I believe, and this is only my observation, that you can't make one out of one that one is just that simple. Or I would have gotten here first or died drunk. I thank God every day. I thank God every day for that. We went back to Dallas, David went back to school, and I went to work. And we had everything going for us that any young people could hope for. We didn't have much money. We didn't need much money. But every time we had a few dollars extra, we bought a bottle. And every time we did, he drank too much. And every time he did, I was furious. Why couldn't he drink like so-and-so? Why couldn't he drink like I drank? And on, the broken record, the broken record. So many of us who love a drunk, who don't even like a drunk, say that. Use those same, why can't they? Why can't they? You see, I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable over 53 years ago. And I didn't know it. I did not know it. David graduated from Southern Methodist University and he was serving a residency at Methodist Hospital in Dallas, a surgery residency. And I lived in a little apartment a couple blocks away because he had to stay in the hospital. And he had a pass once a month for the weekend, and it was his weekend off, and we were going to fraternity camps. He came home, we borrowed his mom's car because they didn't have one, and we sallied forth to have a great evening, a wonderful evening. And we were back home an hour and a half later because he had drunk too much. My little apartment was at the top of a stairwell that went straight up like so, and I had to get behind him to keep him from falling. And just as we got to the top of the landing, he passed out. And you know what I wanted to do. And it would have been so easy. He's a little guy, and I was an athlete all of my life. And I'm a big gal. I didn't do it. I dug him in by his heels, and I left him passed out in the middle of the floor. And when he came to the next morning, he wanted to know what happened. And I looked at him with all the resentment and all the anger and all the disgust. And I said, yes, and turned my back. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Sane, normal, sound thinking people don't think the thoughts that I thought that night or that I was to think many, many times in the years to come. He wasn't allowed to finish his residency. He was Navy Reserve and he was called to active duty with the United States Navy. He was declared an officer and a gentleman, and I was able to go with him, and we had fantastic duty. The kind of duty you dream about. We started out at Treasure Island out of San Francisco and ended up aboard a carrier at Coronado Naval Air Station in Southern California. And we had more money than we ever had. And we had a fantastic time. We partied, we played, we drank, we fought, and we made up. It was always so much fun making up. You forget about the rotten, nasty things you say to one another the night before. We went from Coronado Naval Air to Bremerton, Washington, where he was mustered out. And we came back to Dallas. Opened an office, I went to work for him, and we were there for 5 years. And during those 5 years, everything that we dreamed about happened. We had a perfectly wonderful practice. We built our first home. Our two sons were born. I had always wanted 6 children. Today I say thank you, God. And everything was great. But we had one little thing going for us that we didn't expect, and that was alcohol. And neither one of us knew anything about alcoholism. We blamed it. We're so good at blaming. The if onlys and the yes buts you don't understand. If only we had not come back to Dallas. If only we had gone to the valley. If only. And you know, and I know, it wouldn't have made a bit of difference. Not a bit of difference. We were in Dallas for 5 years. And at the end of that time, we were bankrupt in every area of our lives. Spiritually, mentally, emotionally, our marriage shot. financially, and there was no reason for it because we were very successful. But you see, alcohol takes you down all the way because it's progressive. And we never know how far down we have to go before we can start climbing up. And we had no idea. At the end of 5 years, he was recalled active duty. And we were delighted because we felt that just maybe by the time he served the time that we'd be in, that it would get better and things would be different. Not knowing that alcoholism doesn't ever get better. That it only gets worse. Downhill, all the way, a progressive illness, cunning, baffling, powerful, an insidious disease. And again, we had no idea, no idea. It was decided that Hilton and I would stay in Dallas, and he'd only be gone a short time, and he was gone 2 weeks when he called and wanted to know how soon we could join him. The house went on the market, the furniture went into storage, and the kids and I were on our way. You see, we needed each other. The thick dependency that we have for each other. We can't live with them, we can't live without them. It's a vicious cycle. It's a vicious cycle. We had had a live-in housekeeper. She was placed with another family. We could no longer afford her. And the boys and I sallied forth to California. Again, fantastic duty. We lived in San Clemente, California. This time he was attached to the Marines. And we lived in what then was a very small town of San Clemente, California. 2,500 people, and it was beautiful. It was picturesque. They had a building code back then. Everything had to be white stucco with red tile roofs. And it looked just like a painting out of Spain. And it was very safe, and it was very secure. And you know what we were doing? We were taking this with us every place we went. It wouldn't have made any difference where we went. We didn't have a living housekeeper, but we had babysitters at our disposal. And so what we did, I became a mother during the day. I took the kids to the beach and did the things that moms do. And then at night, we hired a babysitter so we could party and play and drink and fight and make up. And it's always so darn much fun making up. You forget about the rotten, nasty, ugly things you say together the night before. And it isn't going to ever happen again until the next time. And the next time. And the next time. He was sent to Hawaii on temporary duty, and the children and I stayed in California. He was to send his paycheck home twice a month because officers weren't required to sign over in the lobby back then. And the money didn't arrive. And I didn't understand it. And I called him in Hawaii. And he didn't understand it because he mailed it yesterday. And we waited, and it didn't arrive. And I called him back. And it was mailed yesterday. And it didn't arrive. And then I went to the base legal officer. Now, I didn't go to get a divorce. I went to embarrass this man and humiliate him, and I did it joyfully, gleefully. He was threatened with a court-martial. I thought, that'll show him. That'll show him. He had to sign over an allotment. And I was going to leave as soon as he got back. I was just waiting to confront him. And then I would go back to Denver and get on with the business of living. And my phone rang about 3:30 one morning. And the ship was going to tie up in San Diego, and with the children and I meeting. And you know what I did. Got the kids dressed in their Sunday best, and we headed for San Diego. We watched Dad get off the ship, and he had on his dress blues, and God, he looked good. And all that anger and that resentment that I'd been building up while he was gone went right out into the Pacific, I thought. You and I in this room know where it went. It went down in this hole that every one of us have, where we build layer by layer by layer. All of the anger, all of the hostility, all of the things that happen to us. Because we don't know how to get rid of it. We don't know where to go with it. And it builds until we get here. And we get to steps 4 and 5. And 6 and 7. And we're relieved of that horrible, horrible layer of ugliness that's inside of us. Only I didn't know that. Dad was home, and everything was going to be wonderful this time, and we got right back into the same old vicious cycle. Party, play, drink, fight, and make up. We did not have physical battles in our home, and I know David thanks God to this day, but we had verbal battles. The verbal battles were horrendous. I learned every rotten, nasty word known to man. I don't know where I learned them, not from him and not from my family. But I learned them and I used them on him. I stripped this man of every bit of dignity that he ever had. I'm not proud of it. It's just the way it was. I have not forgotten one of those words. But I pray to God of my understanding that no one in this fellowship, whether they be AA, Al-Anon, or Al-Ateen, will ever hear me use one of those words in a meeting or behind this podium. Because our program is one of dignity and not disgrace. Alcoholism is an illness and nothing to be ashamed of. I have never found one of those words in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous or any of our Al-Anon or AA literature. It's necessary for me to talk about that because maybe it doesn't happen in Paris, Texas, but it happens in Dallas, Texas. And some of the words that I hear in our meetings just absolutely curdle me. I don't understand it. I don't understand it. We weren't in San Clemente very long, and he was shipped to the Far East with the division that he was attached to. And it was at this point in time that the children and I moved back to Denver to be close to my family. We thought it would be a very brief period of time, and it turned into 3 years. And it was 3 years of desertion. And I'd love to stand up here and tell you I grew wings and I grew a halo and I'd be lying through my teeth. I'm sure that I cried a number of buckets of tears. Gosh knows, days, weeks, I don't know. I lose track of time anyway. And then I thought, I'm going to show that son of a gun. And I set out to show him. I set out to find somebody to rescue me. Not proud of those days, that's just the way it was. And where did I go? I had access to all of the officers' clubs in Denver. And I made darn good use of them. And it doesn't take you long. I loved Lowry Air Force Base Officers Club. I'm sorry that it is no longer. I was home a few weeks ago, and it was sad to go by the base and see that it is no more. But the club was safe. I felt safe in there. And the bar was wonderful. Short end of the bar here, long end of the bar here. And I always managed to get a stool at the short end of the bar. One evening only. He gave me the opportunity to look you fellas over. And every one of you knew what I was there for. Some of you gals do, because you shared with me, you've done the same thing. It wouldn't be very long, there'd be a drink in front of me. And very shortly, someone's standing beside me, and they're lighting my cigarette, and you know what happens. God, you're looking into one another's eyes, and instant love. It didn't take long. And he was going to send me to Mexico for an illegal divorce, and I darn near took him up on it. I went to our family physician and his wife, who were like second parents to my brothers and me. And they loved me and accepted me the way I was. And when I shared the whole story to them, they didn't blame me. They did what every one of us, to me, what every one of us has happened to, I think, one time or another, was involved with a drunk. They patted me and they loved on me and they said, "We don't blame you, honey, we understand." They didn't understand because they didn't know any more about alcoholism than I did. But they would have gone along with me because they cared for me. However, they made one suggestion, and that was that I go home and get a piece of paper and a pencil and put David on one side and this young man on the other. And I did that. Write down everything you like about them and everything you dislike about them. And I did that. And you know what I had? I had one in Denver, and I had one in the Far East. I didn't know what they were, but they were exactly alike. I introduced him to one of my former classmates, and 10 days later they were married. That should tell you something. You know, I found out in here, if you get rid of one, you're just going to go get another one. You might as well hang on to the one you have. You don't know what the next one's going to be like. I went right back out to the Elsie Club, and this time there he was, the man of my fantasy, a former All-American football player, a full colonel. From colonel you go to general, right? I had it all planned. The Air Force was going to know the greatest general's wife they've ever had, and there I was. I failed to hear or to pay attention to what the colonel said to me the first night I met him. He had just been shipped back from Korea due to a drinking problem. All he needed in his life was stability, and here I was. A built-in family, and everything was going to be wonderful. And you know better than that, don't you? Went on for a while, and I was not raised this way. I grew up in a very fine family, I told you that. Dad was one of nine and mother was one of seven. And my grandparents settled in Colorado in the late 1800s. And you know, with that many aunts and uncles, you've got lots of cousins too. And I couldn't go anywhere with a current romance of the day that I didn't run into one or more family members. And you know, not one time did my parents or my brothers, their wives, any one of them ever say, "You're embarrassing us. You should not. You ought not." They allowed me the right to be wrong, the dignity of making my own mistakes, and I will be eternally grateful for that. When I got to you people and got to steps 8 and 9, and I was making my amends, and my family was on that list, of course they were, and I didn't know how to go to them and say I'm sorry, because I had misused and abused those words. If you were like I was many times, I was sorry just for being me, for getting up, for going to bed, if it did or if it didn't, whatever. And thanks to a loving sponsor, one went to her with this. And she said, "Honey, has it ever occurred to you to go to your parents, your family, and say thank you for loving you when you were not lovable?" That had never occurred to me. And I was able to go to my family with those words. And you know, they didn't know what I was talking about, because they just kept on loving me anyway. But it was okay, because I had to do it for me, because it was not what they expected of this gal standing here. You know, I had tried to get a divorce, and I couldn't, because he couldn't be served. And I was waiting for him to come back and then serve him. And you know, sooner or later, they're going to come back. If you ever tried to get rid of a drunk, you know what I'm talking about. You know, 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, they're going to show back up. Never going to happen again, of course. And my phone rang in Denver one day, and you know who, and I hung up. Hung up the second time, and the third time I listened, and all he wanted me to do was to fly out to California and see if we couldn't put it back together. And there wasn't any way I was going till the next day. I got on the plane. Now, I wasn't going to stay. I was going to serve him with the papers. And then I was going back to Denver, get over with this thing, and start living the normal life. I don't know what normal is. I believe we in here are probably the most normal people in the world today. But that's my own belief. I got off the plane in Oakland, California, and he was standing there in his dress blues. And we walked into the bar, and we had a drink, and we started talking, and then we went on into the city, and we had a few more drinks and a few more talks. And I went back to Denver 3 or 4 days later to wait for Dad to be released from active duty, start all over. He picked us up in Denver, we went back to Dallas. We stayed a short time, not very many months. And then we moved out towards the Panhandle, a little town of Crowell, Texas. We stayed there less than a year because we darn near starved to death. There just wasn't enough for us to make our expenses. And we moved further into the Panhandle to the little town of Memphis, Texas. Between Childress and Amarillo, and a lovely, wonderful little town. Beautiful people who loved and accepted us just the way we were. And you know what we were doing, only we didn't know what we were doing. We were taking us with us every place we went. And here we learn it's a geographic cure. Well, there is no cure for geographics. I'm a perfect example of that. Let me tell you, we didn't know that. We didn't know that. At the end of 8 years, we were bankrupt one more time in every area of our lives. Every area. Because you see, wherever we went, we partied, we played, we drank, we fought, and we made up. Over and over and over and over again. Dave called me one day from the office, and he said, "I think we ought to move back to Dallas." And I said, "How soon?" And we were gone 2 weeks later. We lied to those wonderful people in that community. We told him we were going back because his folks needed us. They didn't. His father had retired, and he and Grandma were doing all the things on retirement, the bailiff land. But they got us. A girl's son, a confused daughter-in-law, and two mixed-up grandsons. Today, I thank the God of my understanding that allowed these two people to live long enough to know a sober son and see a family putting their lives back together one day at a time through this beautiful fellowship. But we still had 3 more years of drinking. I went to work almost immediately, and I had a very fine job, and I made big money for a woman back then. I was self-supporting through my own contributions. Our son's education was taken care of through a trust fund set up by my parents. I didn't have that to worry about. I could have left any hour of any day of any week, and I chose to stay. That was my choice. Today I don't regret it. Today I don't regret it at all. During those 3 years, the last 3 years of drinking, there is no way, I don't believe, that we could have gone any further down than we went, both of us, in our own inimitable way. During those 3 years, I planned his murder. And I would lie in bed many, many nights, thinking ways to do it. And I came up with a perfect solution. And I don't talk about it anymore because somebody might be sicker than I was before. I planned my own suicide. I never planned to kill myself all the way. I told you I'd worked in his office. And pharmaceutical detail men used to leave cardboard cartons of every drug that ever came out on the market. Thank God Dave never got into those. He just threw a box back in the lab and never even opened it. But I would. And I would steal what I thought would either get rid of him or me. And I had a private stash at home. I was going through one of my depressions. That's a good word for poor me, why me, boo-hoo. And I sent the kids to Grandma's. And I was going to overdose. And he was going to be home and be sorry. And you have to understand, David was to stay away from home drunk. Like you, Joe. He just didn't come home many nights. And whatever made me think he would be home that night, I had no idea. But the kids were at Grandma's, and I got myself all gussied up and ready for bed, and I overdosed on a sleeping pill, and I knew just exactly how much to take. And he was going to be sorry. And I came to him 24 hours later with the only hangover I've ever had in my life. He had not been home. Nothing wrong with me, of course not. Some months later, I decided that if I turned on the gas, things would be just wonderful. Because David was a cigar smoker. And I figured that sooner or later, you know, he's got to come home. And I figured that in a few days, he's got to come in for a change. And I sent the kids to Grandma's. And I had already figured it out that I would be in my room and I would escape this, you understand. Our fireplace in the den. Kitchen. One of those where the kitchen and the den are all combined in the dining area. And the garage was attached. Now David was very meticulous about his driving when he was under the influence. He barely accelerated the car. He didn't get a DUI for that reason. And he was also very particular when he drove into the garage, very carefully so he wouldn't hit my car. And then he would pull the garage down very slowly, come in the screen to the den, and the den door, he'd lock the screen, he'd lock the den door, make sure that everything was in order. And I thought, okay, that's what he's going to do. And he's going to come in with a lighted cigar, and the gas jets are going to be turned on, and he's going to be blown to kingdom come. And I got all the these in bed, and the house was entirely electric. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. Nothing wrong with me, of course not. My phone rang in my office one day, and he said, I know you don't believe me, but I'm going to meet you with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't care. You see, I firmly believe that we who love the problem drinker
have our own bottoms to hit, just as the alcoholic does, just as the drinker does. And we can only go so far before we start climbing back up. And approximately 6 months prior to that call, I was on my way home from work one evening, and I knew I had to talk to him. And I didn't know where he was. And there are no coincidences, because he was in the den when I walked in. And I told him I wanted to talk to him. Now, you know, and I know, it wasn't the first little chat I'd had with him. I'd had many. And I don't blame him, really. He said, "What's it about this time?" And this time it was totally different, because I was as calm as I am right now. And I sat down and I said, "David, to tell you something, I no longer care. What you do, where, when, how, or with whom, you're no longer a part of our lives. And just as soon as both of the boys are gone, I will be gone. You're free to stay or you're free to go. That's up to you." And I turned my back and I walked into my room. I closed my door. I went to bed that night and I slept the night through. And I've been sleeping ever since. I had no idea what happened. No idea till I got to you. So when that call came in my office that day, I didn't care. And that was the point that I had to get to for me in order to survive. And I firmly believe that was God doing for me what I was incapable of doing for myself. There was not a meeting in Dallas that night. We didn't have meetings 10 times a day, 7 days a week like we do today. There were only a few meetings a week. And so he was home that evening when I got home. And there was no communication. And the next day he called me back in the office with the same statement, and he got the same response from me: "Be my guest." And I hung up. And that evening when I got home, he was dressed and he walked out the door to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our oldest son was in UT Austin at the time, and Donnie finishing high school. And he said, "Mom, do you think Dad really means it? Or is it another one of his lies?" And I said, "Honey, we won't know till Dad comes home." And that was April 21, 1967. And we've been coming home ever since. Now, there was not any instant anything in our home. Instant love, instant communication, instant sobriety. Don't misunderstand me. He had not had a drink since April 20th of 67. But we don't get sick overnight. And we are not going to get well overnight. You and I, when we call ourselves members of Alcoholics Anonymous, or Al-Anon, have accepted a responsibility of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And when that new guy or gal walks through the doors, let's not promise something we can't deliver. Let's not say, "Come on in, the water's fine. Come on in. Your husband, your wife, your sister, your brother, your father, your mother, your lover's going to get sober. And everything's going to be beautiful." We can't promise that, because we don't know. It may turn into an absolute disaster, but what we can promise is that no situation is so difficult and no unhappiness too great that it cannot be overcome. And how do we do this? Through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the recovery therein. Not Al-Anon's 12 steps, because we don't have them. They're AA's 12 steps that they don't generously gave to us to recover by. 1 week after his first meeting, he invited me to go to an open AA meeting, and I probably beat him to the car, as my recollection goes. Now, our program is one of attraction rather than promotion, right? And I have to tell you what attracted me to you and why I was so eager to get to that meeting. He had been changing his clothes, taking a bath every night, clean underwear, clean clothes, every day. That's how I got to you people. I'm a firm believer, any way you get us here, get us. And I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't ever want to forget it, because it began a love affair for me that goes on to this moment. And I don't ever want it to end. I walked into a room full of over 125 people. And They were wonderful. They were laughing and they were happy and they smelled good. The guys all had on their funeral suits and the gals all had on their Sunday go-to-meeting clothes. Because that's the way we dressed back then. We dressed up in the best thing we had. We didn't go in shorts and all this other stuff back then. And it was grand. And I was home free. It was just wonderful. I don't know what went on in that meeting. I have no idea. I don't remember one thing about it, except those people and the feeling down in here. It was just, it's still exciting to me every time I walk into a meeting. And I don't want to lose that excitement. On Monday night, he said, "How would you like to go now in a meeting?" And I said, "What's that?" He said, "I have no idea, but I think it's for you." And I don't ever want to forget my first Al-Anon meeting. Because I walked into a room full of the most pious gods I've ever encountered. And those women were so good that I literally wanted to throw up. There were a group of gals sitting over here, and they were knitting and or needlepointing. I didn't do either one. I needlepoint today, but not in meetings. A couple of them over here were real excited about a new jelly recipe. I've been buying my jelly at the supermarket ever since marriage, and I haven't done anything wrong with it. If you want to spend dollars, can, and good for you, I'll eat your jelly, but I'm not going to make it. They talked about how good they were to those drunks. That they made sure that they were in bed so they know where they were the next morning. I wanted mine dead in the gutter. They talked about making sure that they were fed so they wouldn't go hungry, and I wanted mine to starve to death. I couldn't identify. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. We share not only our experience, strength, and hope, but our fears. Because I believe we walk in here, whether we be AA, Al-Anon, or LD, scared to death. Because we don't know what we're walking into. People out there think we're a cult. Is that what we think we are when we first get here? We don't know. And if we don't share, Joe talked about having to give it away in order to keep it. It's one heck of a responsibility. I kept going to those meetings because I didn't know you could go anywhere else to an Al-Anon meeting. And if I were in a turtle race, I'd be the last one in because I was there for 4 years. You don't hear and you hear and you don't see what you see. And I look forward to the open meetings every Friday night. And to the conventions that we started going to, and the meetings that we drive to Longview and Tyler, we hear about a meeting and we get in the car and load up the car and away we go. We went as far as we could go, as often as we could. And just kept on going. And I finally, my first sponsor died with 37 years and 11 months of continuous sobriety because I couldn't identify with the Al-Anons. And Chris had never been to an Al-Anon meeting, and she'd never sponsored an Al-Anon, and I said, "But I've got to have a sponsor." And she said, "Well, give it a go." And I went to her one night, and I said, "Chris, I would like to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't identify with those women, and I'm not happy, and I don't want to be in there, and I've drunk a whole lot more booze than a lot of those gals in AA have drunk." And she said, "I'll tell you what, honey, come with me." She went into the office and bought me my first big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She turned to chapter 4, the first page, and she said, "Read this right here, this sentence." And it says, "If you honestly want to and cannot quit entirely, or if from drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic." She said, "Now, honey, does that fit you? And if it does, I'll see that you get a chip Monday night." You see, it didn't fit me. Alcohol never did to, with, and for me what it does for the problem drinker. If I drank too much, I got drunk, and then I would get sick. And I never wanted a drink in my life. Never had a hangover. I still think booze is the lousiest tasting stuff I've ever put in my mouth. No matter how I disguised it, it never tasted good to me. But you know what I was doing. I was drinking with him, at him, get even with him, get ahead of him, drinking for all the wrong reasons. All the wrong reasons. So I had to keep going back in that room with those savvy brides. We didn't have any men back then. And in 1971, I was in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada, and I heard a drunk from Raleigh, North Carolina, had heard him prior to that many times since. And Dave always says it was God. If you don't think it breaks the best, get yourself another. Pretty profound statement, isn't it? How simple can you be? And I knew I wasn't going back there. And on Monday night, I went to Preston for the first time. And I walked in to my home group. And I was there for the next 24 years. I walked into a room full of honest, open-minded people that were willing to share everything with me. And I was there a short time when they asked me to be an Alateen sponsor, and I had that great gift for 6 years. Those kids taught me about loving for free with no strings attached. They were something else. Unconditional love. And I'll be eternally grateful. They taught me what love was really about. All those years I was falling in love with the military, I was in heat and I didn't know what it was. You know, it takes a long time to learn a lot of things, doesn't it? I got an Al-Anon sponsor when I got over there after a little while, and Bonnie was one of the most gentle, loving women I've ever known in my life. And was in the program 29 years. She never used a word of profanity, never said an unkind word about a human being. She taught me about patience, and she taught me about tolerance. She was an example of what this program is. And I will be eternally grateful. We buried Bonnie last April, but she had had Alzheimer's for 5 years. And all she ever said to me, she said, "Honey, every time you ask, you go." And I've tried to do that all these years. A year ago, I became very uncomfortable in the group that I was in. Very uncomfortable. Because the traditions are so important to me. They're as important to me as the 12 steps are. And our third tradition specifically tells us that we have a requirement for membership just as AA does. And our fifth tradition tells us what the purpose is. And I found that people were coming into our room, into our meetings, that have never even smelled alcohol, never been around it, looking for a better way of life. And we in this fellowship cannot be all things for all people. And it kept happening, and it kept happening, and it was eating my lunch. Because I have to be active, and I have to be a member of Al-Anon. And I have to continue working with others. I sponsor people. I have to be available. And it finally occurred to me that if I didn't think my group was the best, I better get another. And I left my group, and it's been a very tough, heartbreaking thing for me. They're doing just fine without me, please understand. They don't even miss me, I'm sure. But I now go to the Horizons group. It's a daytime meeting, and we don't have any fog at all going on. We just stay within the confines of the program, and it's very healthy. We're a very healthy group of people, and there are a lot of newcomers coming in. I work in our Al-Anon Information Center once a week as a volunteer, and any other times that I'm needed, and I get a lot of 12-step referrals that way. I mean, I refer them to groups closest to them. And it's amazing how many calls come in that the people at the other end have been referred to us from their physician, psychologist, psychiatrist, counselors that have never been around alcoholism. And it's my responsibility to direct them to whatever recovery group is necessary. You see, there are over 225 recovery programs based on our 12 steps. And we cannot be all things for all people. Our two sons are men today, and they're two of the finest young men I know. They're fantastic guys. They don't drink. They don't smoke. They're just really neat, successful men. Our older son's an attorney, and 2 years ago, he gave up a practice in Washington, D.C., and moved to Missoula, Montana. One of the coldest places in the world, I believe. And he fulfilling a lifelong dream. He is the attorney for the university, and he's getting to teach law school. He thinks he's a teenager again. It's what he's always wanted. And he took our daughter-in-law that is just like my own child. I couldn't love her anymore if I'd had her. And our two little granddaughters. We all lived with great grandparents, and here we are just playing grandma to 6 and a 12-year-old. And out there wonderful. And we're going to be there at Christmas, and I'm only looking forward to the kids and not the weather. We were there 2 Christmases ago, and let me tell you, if anybody wants to do praise, just take a trip to Montana. I remember some empty prisoners in Asia asked his company to transfer him back to the States, and he is now in South Florida. He's a very successful businessman, and he's a wonderful guy, and he was married to still married, barely, to a beautiful little gal. Our older daughter-in-law is from Santiago, Chile, and our granddaughters are bilingual. And our other little daughter-in-law is from Iraq. We have a United Nations family. And she's a little darling. But she doesn't want to live in the States, and Donnie doesn't want to go back to Asia, and she just was visiting me last week, and she's now back in Australia with her family where they are retired. And I don't think they're going to make it. And you know, being a typical Al-Anon, and I want to fix it. I want to put it in a little blue box with a little red ribbon around it and say everything's going to be beautiful. And you taught me to mind my own business. And it's not been easy. Because they love each other. But there's no too much faith and not enough give, I guess. I don't know. Nobody knows what goes on behind anybody's bedroom door, and I know they both have their faults. So all I can do is just keep on loving them and stay out of their way. David, many of you know, and he's one of the finest members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I know, as well loved and respected throughout, not just the U.S., but Canada and throughout the world. And I would like for him to do a lot of changes. And you know he doesn't pay a bit of attention to me. I've never heard him say no since the day he walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he goes, I'm sure he'll be behind one of these or a dental chair. And he'll be happy. And I can't think of a better way. But we're both getting older, and I'd like for him to slow down, and he's just not going to do it. So we accept the things we cannot change. And I try to stay out of his way. And we agree to disagree. You know, I mean, we've been married 53 years this last June, for God's sakes. That's a long time to be married to a drunk. And he has a wonderful program. I have my program. And consequently, there's no situation so difficult, and no unhappiness too great, that we cannot overcome with our respective programs. And we have a good time. We don't see each other that much. This weekend he was in Kansas City. Last weekend he was in California. The weekend before I was in Oregon, and he was in Shreveport, I guess. And then the weekend before that we were both in Florida, or vice versa, I forget which weekend. So we get to travel a lot together, but separately a lot too. And we have a good time. I don't know of a better way to try to give back to you what's been given to me than to avail myself whenever I'm asked, and to be responsible when anyone anywhere reaches out for help. I love the ABCs at the end of the 5th chapter, and I have my own ABCs, and that's accept and begin and continue. And when we come in here, and I believe we accept the fact that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable, we begin to believe in something, a power greater than ourselves, who I personally choose to call God. And then that happens. And when it does, we continue on the happy road to destiny. Well, surely we will meet again. Thank you again, and God bless you.